Dahl.
Mr. Losman.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is John Losman, and I represent the plaintiffs in this case, which are the Technical Engineering Union and the Benefit Funds. Because there's more than one plaintiff, I generally refer to them collectively as the funds. In this matter, there are two appeals, the first of which is the funds' appeal from the summary judgment that the district court entered against them in their compliance audit action, and the second of which is the funds' appeal from the attorney fee award that the district court entered against them as a result of bringing the compliance audit action. I'm going to address the fee award first. It's long been established, that the court's discretion to award fees under ERISA 1132G1 is non-unlimited. This court has established some good guidance for district courts to follow. For instance, the court has recognized the five factors test, which we discussed in our brief and which this court followed and applied in the case of Carr Brothers, which was a case involving factually similar circumstances and in which no fees were awarded to the employer. The court
But your case is pretty frivolous. I mean, you fasten on the fact that he filed this, filed this annual report, but he didn't employ any members of the unions. So I don't understand why you brought the case.
Well, Your Honor, of course, the funds have an obligation to audit, to police contributions.
They didn't have an obligation to file frivolous claims just because it's a trustee. There's no basis for thinking he employed any of these union members, without contributing to their pension fund.
Your Honor, I might suggest that's exactly the reason for a compliance audit, to ensure that that employers' reports are, in fact, true and accurate. Sometimes employers file reports claiming they employ no one. Sometimes employers file reports claiming that they've much fewer hours than were actually worked. And so it's incumbent on the funds.
What's the evidence of that here?
Well, I'm talking about when the suit was filed, Judge. And there is a lot more evidence.
You kept pursuing the suit. You didn't just file it and drop it. So what is the evidence? What evidence did you ever come up with?
That there was a CBA in effect, Judge?
No, that they were not contributing when they should have.
Your Honor, what happened in this case is that after the compliance audit was done, it was determined that the employer had subcontracted in violation of the contract.
But they're allowed to subcontract.
They're allowed under certain restrictions, Your Honor. They're not simply allowed to freely subcontract. There are restrictions set forth in both the text of the collective bargaining agreement and in the text of the standard agreement that was incorporated in the collective bargaining agreement. And that was the root of the problem in this case, Judge. When the auditor went out, the auditor found that the employer had been subcontracting and specifically requested...
What is it you rely on for the proposition that this was forbidden subcontracting?
There are the provisions in the contract itself, Judge.
What language?
I'm sorry, Judge, we discussed it in the brief, Judge. I didn't put it in my notes.
Your whole argument, though, so you ought to know what it is.
It's discussed on page 9 of our brief, Your Honor. The language is set forth in Article 1, Section 5 of the Collective Bargaining Agreement, and it provides for two circumstances. It provides that employers may subcontract out when the exercise thereof is outside the direct control of the employer, and that's what we refer to as the control situation. It provides that subcontracting may also be done to a licensed professional engineer or surveyor when all the crew members are also licensed. And frankly, Judge, that's very unusual because engineering crews are not fully licensed. In addition to that,
the collective bargaining agreement provides that employers reserve the right to contract out. That's quite flat.
Reserve the right in those circumstances, Your Honor.
It doesn't say in those circumstances.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree because...
Well, I'm reading what it says in the Section 5 of the Collective Bargaining Agreement.
And I believe that you're not quoting the section entirely, Judge, because to enter into a collective bargaining agreement...
Employers reserve the right to contract out line and grade work, and the union recognizes this reservation and agrees not to interfere with the exercise thereof when outside the direct control of the employer.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that that's key language right there, when outside the direct control of the employer. The employer is only allowed to subcontract out in this particular circumstance, when outside the direct control of the employer. There is not a provision in this contract saying, oh, by the way...
Says the employer reserves the right to subcontract out survey work and line and grade work, etc., to any licensed professional engineer or surveyor.
Yes, Your Honor, that's the second circumstance in which it's allowed. But my point is that...
There's no qualification there about direct control.
Well, it's to any licensed surveyor or engineer when all the members of the crew are also licensed. So I think that that's actually a very restrictive provision in the real world, because surveying crews don't use fully licensed members. And in addition to this, Your Honor, the collective bargaining...
What's your argument that what they did didn't fit this Section 5?
Yes, Your Honor, that's right. And it also does not...
Well, why didn't it fit Section 5?
Well, there's no competent evidence in this case that it did, Your Honor.
You've got the burden of proof. You're the plaintiff. What's the evidence that they violated Section 5?
Well, Your Honor, the audit report attached to the amended complaint established that the auditors went out to perform the compliance audit in this case. And the affidavits by the auditors specifically established that they requested information from the employer to confirm that its contracting fit the requirements of the collective bargaining agreement. And in fact, none of that information was provided. The auditor completed the audit, found that there were delinquencies based on the breach of the collective bargaining agreement, and that was the basis of that was attached to the amended complaint, Judge.
You're saying there is evidence of violation of Section 5, or they just didn't furnish information that...
I'm saying there was no information provided by the auditor to show that their subcontracting fit within the restrictions under the agreement.
Why do they have to show that?
Because the subcontracting...
Do you have to have evidence that they violated the contract?
We tried to obtain that evidence, Your Honor.
What blocked you from obtaining it?
The employer did not provide it, Judge.
What about a subpoena? Deposition?
Those certainly would have been useful, Judge.
I mean, useful. It would have been necessary to obtain actual evidence of a violation.
Yes, Your Honor.
And why didn't you do that?
Had the funds had any idea to believe that the employer even contended that the subcontracting was done pursuant to the contract. And I just emphasize to the court that when the auditor was out at the contractor's premises...
The defendant didn't contend that it was complying with the collective bargaining agreement?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. The auditor in this case specifically asked the president of the contractor if the contractor were contending...
Right, so then you bring a suit, then you have to provide evidence. You have to present evidence. You don't have any evidence of a violation.
Well, we certainly do, Your Honor. The evidence is the audit report that's attached to the amended complaint. The audit report is based on the documents and the information that defendant provided.
I thought you said they didn't provide information.
That's right. They didn't provide any information showing that this subcontracting was provided pursuant to the contract.
They don't have the burden of proof. You have the burden of proof.
Well, we have the burden of proof.
What is the evidence that they violated the collective bargaining agreement?
We have the burden of proof with respect to fund's summary judgment motion. They had the burden of proof with respect to defendant's summary judgment motion. And the evidence in this case is set forth in the audit report, in which the auditor found that they were subcontracting and that there was no evidence that they were provided, that there was subcontractor was pursuant to the collective bargaining.
We know they're subcontracting. The question is the evidence that their subcontracting violates the collective bargaining agreement.
Well, Your Honor, the funds and the auditor are really, in a sense, at the mercy of the employer, because when the auditors go out, they don't create evidence. They simply rely on...
All they have to do is serve a subpoena, deposition, interrogatory and ask, did you, you know, retain control of your subcontractors?
And that is exactly what happened here, Your Honor.
No, you didn't serve that sort of discovery demand.
No, Your Honor, there was no reason to. We had no reason to believe that it was done pursuant to these provisions because the auditor...
You have a complete misunderstanding of litigation.
Your Honor...
You have to prove a violation of a contract. You need evidence.
Yes.
You don't just go to someone and say, give me the information that shows that you're complying with the contract.
When the contractor is seeking to take advantage of a limited subcontracting right set forth in the collective bargaining agreement and in the incorporated standard agreement, Your Honor, and the auditor goes out to perform the audit and says, are you claiming that this information comes within these subcontracting restrictions? And the contractor provides no information to that effect and no documentation to that effect.
That's what makes you suspicious. You bring a lawsuit and you try to prove that indeed it was illegal subcontracting.
Well, Your Honor, I submit that we certainly would have followed up with depositions and interrogatories and document requests on that very issue if the defendant had produced any information or even contended that the subcontracting was supposedly pursuant to these provisions of the contract.
Before you sit down, I'm just troubled by or perplexed by why this defendant is bound by a collective bargaining agreement.
I believe, Your Honor, there's not just ample evidence in this case, but there's overwhelming evidence that the contractor is bound by the collective bargaining agreement. In this case...
They employed some union people 30 years ago for a couple of months, and then 10 years ago for a couple of months, and that's it.
Well, that's not exactly it, Judge. There are three separate aspects to why the employer is bound in this case. The first is the course of conduct, which is after the
filing these reports, saying we didn't have anybody who was working for us.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The businesses simply don't make up things and file reports for no apparent reason. In generally, they continue to file reports not just sporadically but every month for over 6 years. In addition to that, Your Honor, even when they submitted a termination letter to the union, they never claimed that they were not bound during that period of time. And there is another factor in this case, which is they admit that they assigned their bargaining rights and entered into a contract through the contractor association. And thirdly, Your Honor, when plaintiffs filed this suit and defendants answered the complaint, they admitted that there was a contract in effect, at least as of January 1st, 2000.
Well, there's a contract in effect, but whether they're a signatory or bound by it is a disputed issue.
I'm not sure I understand the distinction the court's trying to make. I think that in the circumstance that the contractor would have gone to Local 130 and requested technical engineers, and there were a question about whether the contractor was a union contractor and entitled to obtain workers, I think that the contractor certainly would have pointed probably to all three of those facts, Judge, that the contractor had filed reports every month for over 6 years, that the contractor had this contract through the Lake County Contractors Association, which the contractor never claimed there was any problem with that until this lawsuit, and would have requested Local 130 Tech Engineers. And I think under those circumstances...
Randolph presented affidavits that it was complying, you know, licensed engineers and the direct control, or lack of direct control, rather. So what did you have to contest that?
Your Honor, we moved to strike those affidavits simply because they did not comply with the summary judgment requirements of Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 56E. And that was not competent evidence of subcontracting.
Why?
That complied with the contract. The people didn't have the necessary knowledge, Judge. Their affidavits did not establish that they had the knowledge about the facts that they were seeking to assert. And we sought, and therefore we filed motions to strike. And the district court denied those motions to strike, not because it reviewed the merits of the motions under Rule 56, but because the district court claimed that we should have taken discovery about the subcontracting issues, even though the defendant had never even raised those issues until after the court found that discovery was closed.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So, Ms. Kohler?
May it please the court, counsel, good morning, Your Honors. I would like at the onset to clarify something for the court that was just represented by the counsel for the appellants in this matter. At no time did the plaintiffs in this case file a motion to strike any of the affidavits other than the three employees of Randolph. And the court properly found that those affidavits were proper. There were also affidavits submitted from the specific subcontractors that were in question, that have been in question since the onset of this litigation, and even prior to the audit, the subcontracting issue was their main focus. There were absolutely no motions to strike any of that evidence whatsoever. And if you refer to the record for those specific affidavits, those are from outside third parties that had knowledge of whether or not Randolph had direction or control over using subcontractors for those particular projects. And those particular affidavits and letters to support that evidence has not been contradicted whatsoever in this case by the plaintiffs since the very beginning of this lawsuit. And that actually brings me to a second point, which is throughout the litigation, there has been correspondence back and forth by my co-counsel, who was involved initially in the litigation with plaintiff's counsel, and also by myself during this litigation, where we made it very, very clear that the subcontracting was done properly if, in fact, there was any obligation to bind Randolph whatsoever to any collective bargaining agreement. That is clear in the record through numerous correspondence back and forth between the parties, and there's a recitation of the Carr Brothers case through all the correspondence between both counsel since the very inception of this lawsuit, long before also any discovery cutoff had occurred in this case. So the plaintiffs certainly had the opportunity to conduct any additional third-party discovery that they felt they needed in order to prove a violation of any subcontracting clause, which they failed to do. It is the plaintiff's burden in this case to be able to establish some sort of evidence or contradict the evidence that we brought forward, that we, if in fact this court finds that we even had an obligation to a collective bargaining agreement, that we properly subcontracted for that work. Plaintiffs have failed to do that throughout this case and had every opportunity to do so. This is not a case that we're before the courts of a contractor refusing to pay obligations into benefit funds for its union employees. In fact, as the record establishes, this is a case where Randolph employs several different union members, several different employees of different unions throughout its business. This is a situation, though, where there was no obligation on Randolph's part to pay for the particular subcontractors that the plaintiffs are claiming in this case. This is very unlike the Carr Brothers case that was cited by the plaintiffs throughout this litigation. In fact, that case specifically provides for the award of attorney's fees in this situation. In the Carr case, it was completely different. In that case, it was clear that there was a collective bargaining agreement and an obligation. In that case, it was clear that there was a subcontracting limitation contained within that agreement. Here, since the onset of the litigation, it has been very clear that there has been no ERISA violations whatsoever, even though this lawsuit was brought based on ERISA and the Labor Management Relations Act. Since the very beginning of this case, the plaintiffs were well aware of the fact of the subcontracting issue. There was no course of conduct whatsoever, additionally in this case, to show that we were bound, that Randolph whatsoever was bound to any collective bargaining agreement. There's also interesting in this situation that the plaintiffs had filed a motion to compel, and in their motion to compel, I believe it's at paragraph 16, they specifically apprised the court that they were in need of information pertaining to Randolph subcontracting, which again clarifies that throughout this litigation they continued to litigate, knowing that there was, if in fact there was an agreement, there was a specific subcontracting provision that allowed subcontracting. And even more importantly, there's absolutely no obligation either in the agreement that we maintain we were not bound to or anywhere else in which Randolph agreed or was obligated to pay pension benefits or health and welfare benefits because of subcontractor hours.
What about the first amended complaint, Ms. Culler? Didn't you admit that Randolph was bound by the CBA in the first?
No, Your Honor. It's our position that that was not an admission that they were bound to any of the agreements. The agreements that they had attached to Exhibit A actually were a legal conclusion and weren't even valid attachments. If you look through at those and in our affirmative defense, at number four, we made it very clear that we did not believe we had any obligation to contribute to any pension plan based on subcontractors' work hours. Also, in our amended answer.
Well, you could be bound by the collective bargaining agreement even if you didn't employ union members if you have the obligation, right?
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. If there's a course of conduct, this court has specifically stated that an employer may be bound, such as Randolph, in a situation where there's a course of conduct. There's no evidence in this case whatsoever of course of conduct.
Didn't you submit monthly reports for several years?
Your Honor, we did submit monthly contribution reports, and the key distinction in submitting those reports is nowhere on those reports contains any type of a certification, where in all the cases in this circuit, those certification clauses were in the reports that stated the employer, by signing the contribution reports, agrees to be bound by the provisions of the health and welfare and pension funds.
Well, what was the purpose of the submissions then?
Your Honor, I don't know.
Well, that's how we look at course of conduct sometimes.
It certainly was not an intent to be unequivocally bound to the terms of a collective bargaining agreement, certainly in a situation such as this where Randolph did not even employ any technical engineer, Local 130 employees during the period of time. So as far as a course of conduct, the one element of submitting contribution.
So this was over a period of 6 years or so that filed these?
The contribution reports, yes, Your Honor.
What was its situation when it filed the first one? Do we know?
No, Your Honor. There's no evidence in the record as to the situation of finding the first one.
So we just no evidence as to why they decided at some point to start filing?
Well, at some point in 1977, for a period of 6 months, we had employees.
Right.
1997.
But when does the six-year period start?
I believe it starts with the 1997 period of time, where, in fact, we had, for a period of 2 months, employed Local 130 employees.
So is it plausible that you started filing the reports because you had a covered employee and then just kept on filing?
Yes. That is very plausible and does not show an intent to be bound, especially in light of the fact that there were no Local 130 employees whatsoever, and there is no evidence as to whether they were asked to present these reports either to the union.
Now, Mr. Losman says that you didn't cooperate. I don't mean you personally, obviously, but the company didn't cooperate with the auditors.
Actually, Your Honor, it's undisputed in the record, and I believe it's our response. It's the plaintiff's response to our motion for summary judgment, paragraph 51, where it's undisputed that Randolph has no record of ever receiving any request for an audit prior to the instigating of this lawsuit. That is undisputed by the plaintiffs. So it's our position that the lawsuit was brought without even any type of a request whatsoever for such an audit. In light of that, and also in light of the facts that plaintiffs had other avenues to get the information to prove their claim of a breach of a subcontracting clause. An audit report is not evidence of proof of a breach. Also, there's absolutely no time and point where the plaintiffs sought any third-party discovery. And, in fact, the plaintiffs themselves had filed a summary judgment motion indicating on the same very issues that we filed ours, that there were no genuine issues of material fact and that the court could make its determination as a matter of law. That knowing, you know, the entire time that the basis of this lawsuit has always been contributions for work done by subcontractors. And that was known since the very beginning. However, interesting enough, there's no complaint pleadings and even the amended complaints that notifies the court that, in fact, this lawsuit is seeking contributions for subcontractors. There's only legal conclusions pertaining to, you know, whether or not there were contributions due based on Randolph's employees, even though at all times there weren't any. I'm sorry?
How large a company is Randolph?
At various times, depending on the season, it fluctuates construction-wise, but it's a large construction company. They have several employees that are members of several different unions, as outlined in the Lake County Contractors Association membership. And then it's really also important to point out, it wasn't raised here in oral argument, but I think it's important for the court to also see the nature of the lack of substantial justification for this lawsuit, is the fact that the plaintiffs throughout this case have now also referred to a standard agreement, which they claim has further subcontracting restrictions on Randolph. It's interesting to note that in their short appendix, they have attached a copy of that standard agreement to which they're relying. That agreement is dated April of 2003, which comes after the point of time they maintain that we were bound by any MARBA contract in 2001, and comes after the audit period of time, which goes from January of 2000 to December 31st of 2002. So it just further shows that the award of attorney's fees in this case was not an abuse of discretion by the district court judge. In fact, the court correctly found under both tests that the award of attorney's fees under ERISA 1132 G1, both tests that have been outlined and articulated by this circuit, were properly met in order to award the attorney's fees to the defendants in this matter. In awarding the attorney fees, there are still not any evidence whatsoever presented by the plaintiffs to show any extraordinary or special circumstances that would render this award of attorney's fees against it as being unjust. And in fact, there has been a case where the Seventh Circuit, this court, has allowed a prevailing defendant attorney's fees against an individual employee in the Stark versus PPM case, in which there was an award of over $260,000 based on the fact that the complaint was not substantially justified. Very similar in this case. And the guidance that should have been followed by the plaintiffs in the Carr case clearly was distinguished from the facts in this case. Clearly, the plaintiff relies on Chicago Painters versus Cars, but in that case, while the defendant was the prevailing party on the ERISA claim, and that the court in that case did not award, though, the prevailing defendant attorney's fees on the basis that the plaintiff prevailed on the breach of contract claim. And there is no way in this situation that the plaintiff has brought any evidence whatsoever to even bring forward a genuine issue of material fact of any breach of any claimed contract. So from the onset, it's our position that this complaint has never been grounded in fact or law and was continued to be litigated as such, and therefore we respectfully request that this court affirm the district court's decision in its entirety, including affirming the award of attorney's fees, and also we request that the court award our attorney's fees in defending at this court. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Colra. Mr. Losman, how much time does he have? 1 minute?
Mr. Losman, perhaps Chief Presiding Judge will give you more than a minute. Why did you not have the audit at the front of this litigation? Isn't that normally the course taken?
We had to sue to obtain the audit, Your Honor.
What does that mean?
I don't know.
When a contractor is requested to submit to an audit and the contractor does not do so, then the funds file suit to obtain a compliance audit, and that is what has occurred in this case.
This audit only occurred because you brought the suit? They refused to permit an audit? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. If you look at the original complaint in this case, you'll find that it specifically requests a compliance audit from the period from January 1st, 2000, subsequently. And the reason we brought the suit is because they would not allow the audit. So that was...
Yeah. The other question I have for you is in the fall of 04, November, you tell the district court discovery is over as far as you're concerned. But you don't have the audit report yet, and don't you need that? I mean, I thought this morning you represented that gives the substance to the suit, the results of that audit.
May I respond, Your Honor?
Of course.
What happened is there was a dispute in the course that the funds filed suit to obtain an audit. There was a dispute in the course of the audit about whether the defendant needed to produce documents concerning subcontractors. And in fact, these were invoices concerning subcontractors. The funds filed a motion to compel to obtain that information, and then...
Then you withdrew that motion, though,
then
because...
Produced
the documents.
Because funds produced invoices concerning its subcontracting that identified who the subcontractors were. I disagree with what counsel stated, Your Honor, because the defendant never produced information, even though the auditor specifically requested it, showing that subcontracting would have been done in accordance with the contract. After that was done, after we obtained the invoices, Your Honor, we went to court and told the court that, yeah, the discovery concerning the audit, as we knew it at that time, was completed. And at that time, Your Honor...
You didn't receive the audit until the following February, though.
That's correct, Judge. That's correct. We're only talking about the discovery. Counsel was only referring to the discovery in that sense pertaining to the documents needed to complete the audit. After that time, Your Honor, and in that circumstance, Judge, this was all done pursuant to defendant's original answer in which they had admitted that they were bound by the collective bargaining agreement and they had not asserted any defenses or any affirmative defenses. After that time, Judge, after the audit came out, then the defendant sought to amend its answer, and at that point, defendant submitted some affirmative defenses. And so they didn't raise these defenses until at least 3 months after counsel made that statement to the court that the discovery, the information concerning the audit, had been obtained and that portion of the case was completed.
Now, did you present evidence of their recalcitrance with regard to the audit?
The motion to compel, Your Honor, was seeking invoices concerning...
You say your complaint alleges that they refused a request for an audit.
Yes.
So did you present evidence to substantiate that?
They had refused? No, Your Honor, because once we filed the complaint...
No, but look, your case against award of attorney's fees would be stronger if you actually had proved that they had refused to voluntarily permit an audit.
Your Honor, we never reached that point because after we filed...
Of course you reached the point because you faced an award of attorney's fees. They requested attorney's fees. And at that point you should have said, well, you know, maybe we had a feeble case. We had to sue. It was the only way we could get information about whether they had complied because they refused to voluntarily submit to an audit.
Ms. Kohler said the first time that they got wind of a problem here was the lawsuit, that there was no prior request for audit or information.
Respectfully, I don't believe that's exactly what Ms. Kohler said. I think what she said is that they couldn't find evidence in their file that an audit had been requested.
That's,
and I think that...
That's lawyer talk.
I don't think so, Judge. I think that a defendant has been splitting hairs throughout this case. and making distinctions such as whether it's admitted that it was bound by the collective bargaining agreement based on answers in which there is no denial. And I think that the defendant has never said that there was no audit request. And in fact,
you don't understand that you have an obligation to present evidence. You just don't understand that. You do not understand that. If you want to resist an award of attorney's fees on the ground that they were uncooperative before the complaint was filed and that forced you to file a complaint, then you have to present evidence of that. You don't just say it.
Your Honor, respectfully, the district court's award of attorney's fees was based on the court's belief that there was never a collective bargaining agreement in effect in this case. And we submit that whenever we file a suit for an audit and the defendant comes in and admits, unequivocally admits in its answer that it is bound by the collective bargaining agreement, that there would be no reason for the defendant, the plaintiffs, to try to prove up the defendant is bound by the collective bargaining agreement at that time. And further, Judge, after this case was filed, the defendant said, okay, they then agreed to undergo the audit. Now, the purpose of compliance audit cases, Your Honor, is for the funds to obtain audits to verify compliance. The funds don't get anything out of dragging a case out interminably. So once the contractor agrees to allow the audit, then that's the next step we take. We go ahead and proceed with the audit. We're not interested in proving up facts establishing that beforehand they wouldn't allow the audit, because our purpose in the case is simply to obtain the audit and find out if, in fact, they have complied with the collective bargaining agreement.
If everything broke your way, how many subcontractors who were not appropriate subcontractors under the bargaining agreement would have worked for the company, and what kind of dollars are we talking about in terms of delinquent contributions?
I'm aware that there were six subcontractors, Your Honor. I'm certain for sure that there were three. The amount of delinquency set forth in the audit report is, I believe, just under $31,000.
So we have a $31,000 case that now is $55,000 in attorney's fees. Seems sort of a waste, I guess.
Well, Your Honor,
Wisconsin.
The funds are unlike private parties, Your Honor. I mean, the funds have an obligation under federal.
I know they have a fiduciary duty, but sometimes to spend $55,000 plus attorney's fees on appeal to win $30,000 is not a good exercise of judgment, I guess.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, the fund's attorney's fees were not the same amount. The fund's attorney's fees were somewhat less than what the contractor spent. But of course, the funds are entitled to recover their fees if they prevail under Section 1132 G2. And the funds had every reason to believe that they would prevail, because in this case, and I believe the funds should have prevailed on summary judgment, because in this case, insofar as the issue of whether there's a collective bargaining agreement was in effect, I mean, there's ample evidence in this case of that very fact. But the district court basically dismissed that evidence, and I think ignored the rulings of this court, establishing, for instance, that course of conduct is not only a very real factor, but a potentially dispositive one. Also establishing that...
the course of conduct, the filing of the...
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, the course of conduct is the defendant employed two members in, I believe it was June and July of 1997, and then continued to file reports every month thereafter. Now, I know that... Appellee's counsel has noted that those reports stated that there was no activity, but I don't think the content of the reports is dispositive on that issue. I think that the fact of the matter is the contractor continued to file the reports for 6 years, and as I mentioned earlier, had the contractor at any point in time come in to the local 130 and requested technical engineers to perform a job, I think it's extremely likely that the contractor would have pointed to its continuous pattern of filing reports as evidence that it was a union contractor and was entitled to obtain local 130 technical engineers. In addition, the contractor eventually submitted a termination letter. So in February of 2005, terminating the agreement as of the end of the current collective bargaining agreement, which was May 31, 2005. And even in that termination letter, the contractor did not contend that it was not bound, it had never been bound by the collective bargaining agreement for that entire period.
You know, you make a lot of their having admitted the existence of the collective bargaining agreement, but in their answer to paragraph 9 of your complaint, I'm looking at page 8 of your brief, they said defendant admits to only those obligations imposed by the agreements and denies all allegations inconsistent therewith. That's not an admission of any obligation to you, is it?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. Absolutely. Under Federal Rule Civil Procedure 8D, I mean, what's not denied is admitted. And the allegation here...
No, they say defendant admits to only those obligations imposed by the agreements and denies all allegations inconsistent therewith. Right? That leaves it open for them to argue that the agreements don't impose any obligations on them.
Well, Your Honor, I...
Well,
direct see
how
the
you can
attention.
Take that and say, well, they've admitted. Now it's just a question of how much they owe.
No, Your Honor, I think the issue is the district court found that there was no evidence that they were ever bound by the collective bargaining agreement. And if you look at that same page of our brief, in response to paragraph number 8 of the complaint, in which the allegation is that as of January 1, 2001, there was a collective bargaining agreement.
One is whether they're bound by the contract. The other is whether they're within this right to subcontract clause, right?
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly right.
They haven't admitted that.
Your Honor, once they are bound by the agreement, they are bound by the subcontracting provisions in the agreement.
The question is, but the provision grants a right to subcontract.
Grants a limited right, Your Honor.
Well, but they say they're within that limited right, and they have their evidence. You don't have any contrary evidence.
Well, Your Honor...
You seem to say you didn't have to put in any evidence because you had these... You had the answer to their complaint.
Your Honor, that goes...
Clearly, that answer to paragraph 9 of your complaint doesn't concede that they had no right to subcontract. You see that, don't you?
There is a restricted right of subcontracting under the agreement,
they
Your Honor.
They claim they're within that right.
But there is no competent evidence in the record to establish that.
But you had the burden of proof.
As did they, Judge.
No, can't both have a burden of proof.
These were cross motions for summary judgment, Your Honor. And the district court granted the defendant's motion finding that the contractor had established that it had complied with the subcontracting provisions. And it's our view, Your Honor, that the contractor had not established that because the affidavits that they submitted in support of their Rule 56 motion were deficient.
You have to prove a breach of contract. You don't understand that. There's no breach of contract if they were exercising a right which the contract gave them to subcontract.
Your Honor, I submit that
you have to produce evidence that they subcontracted outside the permitted scope of that clause.
The audit report and the affidavits of the auditors was sufficient evidence to require defendant to rebut the conclusions of the audit report. The only evidence that the defendants used to rebut the conclusions of the audit report was the incompetent evidence that they had presented under Rule 56.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Lossman.
Thank you, Your Honors.